Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another one of these talks between myself and fascinating guest Caleb Maupin. I think people like these conversations because, you know, I'm generally, people see my back, even though I'm a man of the sensible centre left now. A lot of people still see me as a rightist or whatever. You're obviously, you know, from your backgrounds as a Marxist and the far left. But you, I mean, you've had a kind of trajectory where you've at least had some sympathies with MAGA in the past and things like that. Is that right?
Totally. And as I've said many times, I feel that the dissident MAGA community, the people that wanted Trump to end the wars and make America great again and are angry at him for not doing so, they are the most important constituency. I've spent my adult life on the left, and the left is lost completely. It's identity politics. It's just a mess of Malthusianism and pessimism. And I believe there are many Americans that voted for Trump because they wanted to make life better. He didn't do it, but they're sticking to their principles. And so, you know, we've got to build an anti-imperialist movement among the people.
So just before we get going, I'll remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller, Foundations of Shakespeare, also worth checking out. Foundations of Politics is, you know, if you want a real grounding in some of the things I talk about, that would be one to get. Economics is but it's a very Austrian course, so I may have to do like an economics too, where I revise some of that stuff. I mean, it's very difficult because, I mean, without getting off on too much of a tangent, a lot of the Austrian stuff just intuitively makes sense, right? And I still haven't been able to reconcile some of the other things I've learned with some of the stuff I knew there, right? But that's a whole other conversation. Like, for example, the concept of cost being always foregone, or the concept of value being in your head and things like that, like just subjective valuation. I haven't been able to kind of reason myself out of some of those positions because they just make so much sense to me. Then again, I can see a lot of the lies of libertarianism as well, right? And a lot of the things that we've talked about, like last time, you know, central planning can, like the way of force, as in Austria might say, the way of force can also work, right? But anyway, before we get going, Kayla, where can people find you?
Sure. My organization is the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org, and my personal website is CalebMaupinBooks.net.
And today we're going to be talking about perhaps a bit of hidden history, really. In the 1970s, there were these riots in Boston, and you're interested in the communists, or a group of communists who were involved in those. First of all, why don't you lay out some of the context here? What were these riots?
So we're talking about 50 years ago in the 1970s, there were a layer of people who had been involved in the civil rights movement, had been involved in opposing the Vietnam War, had looked to China as an inspiration for building a communist movement, had felt the Communist Party USA was stodgy and old and tailing the Democrats. And they were called the New Communist Movement. And there were a number of these different groups, the October League, the Revolutionary Union, which became the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Communist Workers Party, the Communist Labor Party. There were many different groups. People estimate this group of Americans, there were maybe, you know, 20 to 50,000 people that were part of what they called the New Communist Movement, trying to build a new Communist Party. And they were all over the country. And their understanding was that the hippie counterculture was not in line with what it meant to be a communist, which is very, you know, interesting. I mean, they had short hair. They didn't grow long hair. They refused to use drugs. Many of the groups condemned homosexuality as a bourgeois decadence, as the gay rights movement was getting going. They wanted nothing to do with it. And so in that context, Boston in 1974 implements school busing. And busing was a policy of integrating the schools, right? The idea was that you can't have separate but equal. And that, you know, most major cities in the United States, you had the white side of town and the black side of town. And so the courts in Boston and other cities said, okay, in order to make it fair, we're going to bus students to random schools. You won't go to the school that's in your neighborhood because then we'll have segregation. We're going to bus students to random schools. And the white Catholics of Boston were largely Irish Americans. They don't want their kids to go to school with black people. They're like, no, we want our kids in white schools in our neighborhood. We don't want this. And so for a couple of years, there was a string of riots against busing in Boston. And it was very popular. It was white working class people saying, we don't want school busing. We don't want school integration. You know, there was it was pretty massive, and it spread. There were anti-busing riots in Cleveland and Detroit and other places. So the communist groups were they were kind of like a deer in the headlights. What do we do, right? Now, most of the communist groups supported school busing because, you know, this was a conservative mobilization. These are right wingers. But they had to face a question, which was the Black Panthers were also opposed to school busing because they wanted black schools for black children. And on top of that, who were the major sources supporting busing? The Ford Foundation and some of the wealthiest foundations, because those Irish Catholic and Italian and Polish neighborhoods, they were all public employees. They were police officers, they were firefighters, they were sanitation workers. And that it was understood that part of breaking the labor unions and implementing austerity and laying off public workers was breaking up those communities and breaking the solidarity that those ethnic communities had, right? You know, in a lot of urban areas in the United States, you know, government jobs are handed out on an ethnic basis. Even now in New York City, if you work for the city, you have to be part of your ethnic association. And so breaking up the, you know, the Irish Catholic, you know, kind of network that enabled people to get government jobs was a way of replacing government employees with low wage private sector employees. And so part of school busing was implementing austerity. So what do you do? Well, most communist groups just supported school busing. Some communist groups were careful in that they would kind of highlight the voices of black nationalists that were opposed to busing and say nothing. And there was one communist group in particular, the Revolutionary Union, which became the Revolutionary Communist Party. They actually supported the anti-busing riots. And you could argue that was a mistake. It probably was a mistake on their part. But they wrote an editorial defending their position. And they said, look, if you think that the way to help black people is to dismiss all the white workers as a big pack of racists, you're just serving the ruling class. And they took this position that the answer is communism, not busing. And they were immediately made into pariahs by the left. They were fascists. They were white supremacists. They weren't even on the left anymore. They were just demonized and castigated. And they became kind of the bad example. I was in the Workers' World Party for 8 years. Every year, every single year, we had our national convention. And every year, there was a speech at the national convention. This is in the 2000s. This is like, you know, every year there was a speech about the Boston situation in 1974, and how bad the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Revolutionary Union was for supporting those riots. And it became, I'm calling it the Boston trap. And this is what has corrupted the left. This memo has been sent out. Never support anything that is right wing, right? You know, and as a result of that, the left have just become defenders of the liberal status quo. And it kind of started with that you had a working class uprising in Boston, where the working class was rising up around a cause that was largely motivated by racism. And the left backed into a situation where they were defending the status quo. And it's particularly interesting because there was another uprising the same year in West Virginia, right? And it was in West Virginia, which is very, very heavily unionized at that time. You know, and it was West Virginia, low-income white workers in, you know, Appalachia, rose up against the school textbooks. They implemented new school textbooks that were very liberal and quoted Malcolm X, but also had Darwinian evolution in them. And the local community that were left-wing in the sense they were pro-union, but were evangelical Christians and, you know, fundamentalists, that's very popular in the area. They didn't like the school textbooks. You had the textbook riots. And the Revolutionary Communist Party, the RU, also supported the textbook riots, on the grounds that it was like self-determination. The people of Appalachia have the right to choose what their kids learn in school. Again, castigated. How dare you? How dare you? And it's very, very interesting. And that there's a similar situation. There was a group the LaRouche movement, you know, Lyndon LaRouche. He was originally a Marxist, right? He was a communist. He had a group called the National Caucus of Labor Committees. They were Trotskyite communists. But in New York City, there was a teacher's strike in Harlem, right? The white teachers in Harlem didn't want black community control of schools, right? They didn't want, you know, black nationalists to be running the schools. So they went on strike against it. And the National Caucus of Labor Committees, LaRouche's group, supported the teachers union. whereas the overwhelming majority of the left supported the black nationalists. And they also were kind of made into pariahs. They were the enemy. And they eventually started getting into fistfights with the Communist Party, and they ended up being Republicans, like conservatives, right? And they dropped Marxism for the American system is what they advocate now. The LaRouche movement is still around, the Schiller Institute, also the Promethean Pack. You know, that Linda LaRouche has died. But it's interesting how, like, this memo, it was in the 1970s that you had a wave of communist groups. And a lot of these communist groups had the right instinct, which is we don't want to be part of the mainstream of the left. We don't want to be hippies. We don't want to be part of the counterculture. We don't want to be promoting drug use. We don't want to be promoting, you know, sexual whatever. And then it was like, you can't do that. Right. And I look at what my organization, even now, the Center for Political Innovation, we started out as we called ourselves communists. We were on the left and we got a similar condemnation. Right. And that the left is very controlled. I call this the Boston trap. And it's this understanding you can never support anything, quote unquote, right wing. All the establishment has to do is label something right wing and then you can't support it. And a lot of things that have been labeled right wing were left wing things. Criticizing vaccines, that was a left wing thing. Right. You know, it was leftists. You look at that. It was George Clooney. It was, you know, questioning the medical establishment, alternative medicine. That's been a left wing thing for a long time. But now it's been labeled right wing and you're not allowed to question it. Right. And that this is how the left has been controlled. But it raises the question of, is there a difference between actual socialism, anti-imperialism and the woke left? I think there is. I think there is, and that I would maintain the left as we know it today is just kind of a battering ram used by the ultra rich to kind of bring the austerity and stabilize society. And I look at that situation in Boston in 1974 as kind of a telling example and a negative turning point. What do you think?
It strikes me that I whenever I hear stories like this, I always think, well, where is the deep security state? You know, either the deep state or the security state. Is this coming from the fact that, you know, because, you know, a lot of the stuff that I've done from the right, you could say, is understanding the system that has existed since 1945 in this country and in America as being, to quote Paul Gottfried, an anti-fascist state. It's Polestar, the raison d'etre for the British state and for the American state and for the French state is anti-fascism. Okay. So any little step that you take towards rightwards, okay, is always already on the slippery slope to fascism. Okay. In fact, I've got a name for this. I call it the Boomer Truth Regime. Okay, I don't know if you're familiar with this. And the Boomer Truth Regime has two faces. So picture Winston Churchill doing that in the victory for World War II, okay? And then John Lennon also doing that.
Right.
Okay. So these are the two faces. The ideology of the anti-fascist state is John Lennon's imagine. Imagine there's no people. Imagine there's no countries. Imagine there's no religion. Imagine, you know, or his song God, if you ever heard that. Yeah. I don't believe in Beatles. I don't believe in Elvis. I don't believe in Buddha. I don't believe in that. I just believe in me, Yoko and me. Right.
Yeah.
But then, the role of the Churchill, so that's the always Lennon, John Lennon, that is. The always Churchill is basically somebody who is empowered to be almost the kind of defender of that. And within the system, you're almost allowed to be a fascist as long as you're always defending Lennon.
Right.
And this is the role of the always Churchill. And again, in right-wing circles, there's a reading, for example, of Batman. That Batman is a fascist. In fact, there's a left-wing reading of Batman, too. Batman's a fascist, right? But what is he defending? Batman is always defending the liberal order.
Right.
So in the morality of, like, your Marvel slop or your DC comics or whatever, you're actually allowed to go all the way. This is, you're justified in punching Richard Spencer in the face, right? Antifa. Right. Antifa, right? This is the logic of the whole system. And the thing that, you know, people coming from my side have come to understand is there is no outside of that. We are living in a totalitarian system that will always gatekeep and police those boundaries. So what those people in Boston was probably coming up against were the limits of where they were allowed to go. This is why the FBI and the CIA infiltrated and messed up every Black Panther movement, and why it had to be MLK and not Malcolm X. Because, you know, okay, right, this is Black nationalism, not white nationalism, right? But you're only allowed that insofar as it re-entrenches the anti-fascist state. You are not allowed it if it leads to Black separatism or Malcolm X, or Muhammad Ali even started talking along these lines and was censured at the time in the 70s. And of course, the flip, you know, obviously, if it's white people, it's KKK, it's Nazis, it's all the rest of it. And that is what the state, in my view, the deep state, the secret state, the security state is hypervigilant against anything that looks like it might be that. And it will gatekeep and realign. That's what I would see happening in Boston there. What do you think about all that?
Well, I have had a formulation for a while, and I'm looking at this from a strictly psychological point of view, that, you know, basically the liberal state trains us all to police our thoughts, right? You know, that there are two illiberal sentiments that will just naturally arise among the population. One illiberal sentiment is people tend to be traditional, tribe and tradition. You tend to be loyal to people who look like you, have a similar language, accent, you know, culturally, whatever. You know, people tend to defend the traditional family, things like that. Well, fascism is the boogeyman. If you start to think that way, oh, can't do that, I'm a fascist. And then there's another impulse that people have, is they want the economy to be better. They want the state to step in and make the economy work better for them and take care of them. Well, people are taught not to think that, and then I'm a communist. Right. And communism and fascism have become like the bad example, the boogeyman in your head. Right. And if you start to want the economy to be organized to serve you, you want the government to step in and fight the big banks. But nope, can't do that. I'm a communist. And if you, you know, want to be loyal to people who are like you, you want to hold on to the traditional family, you're not OK with all the can't do that. I'm a fascist. The other thing is that there's a very small number of people in the West who actually do become fascists or communists. And they are told, okay, you can do this, but your job is to go around policing other people, you know, go around stalking the fascists. Or you can be a fascist, but your job is to go around harassing the communists, right? And that kind of arrangement is made, and that's how the liberal order kind of maintains its power. A great example of this, if you want to talk about the right, is the John Birch Society. The John Birch Society was an anti-establishment movement, right? During the 1950s, McCarthyism kind of morphed into some kind of anti-establishment movement, right? That if you look at Joe McCarthy was going after the CIA, he was going after like the Rockefellers and wealthy people, and mainstream media turned on him and he drank himself to death. There was a layer of people in the conservative movement who felt that Joe McCarthy was right, and they were the John Birch Society. Now, the John Birch Society on paper was, they believed in liberty. They were like, you know, conservative libertarians. But what did they end up doing? Stalking leftists, harassing leftists. They were even, interestingly, they were against the Vietnam War. They thought the Vietnam War was like a communist conspiracy to make the case for peace or whatever. It was like the USA was being set up to lose. But yet, if you look at what they did throughout the 1960s, all they did was go around beating up and harassing anti-Vietnam War protesters. And then, I believe in 1968, 69, they ultimately banned any criticism of Israel. And, you know, and today, I mean, and if you look at their website, I mean, they run articles about how RT is a big conspiracy from Russia and we should outlaw RT. And it's like they're supposed to be the anti-establishment right, but they basically just got cornered into stalking the left and policing the left. That's really all they do. And they defend the status quo. And if you look at the left, that's what's happened to the left. The left started out as, you know, you're fighting for socialism, you're fighting against imperialism, you're fighting for the working class. But now, you know, the left, all they do is harass and police the right, right? And make sure that no one does anything right wing. And that this is how the liberal order maintains power. And there are two liberalism is the worship of the individual. All I believe in is me. Like you said, like, you know, it's the worship of the individual above all else, atomizing humanity down into individualism. There are two collectivist illiberal impulses that will naturally show up. One is tribe and tradition. The other is, you know, socialism, right? And the liberal order must police those. I will argue that tribe and tradition is going to fade away gradually. because we're just becoming more integrated with each other and all of that. And I would argue that socialism and the impulse for socialism is going to become more and more necessary because technology is making capitalism much more less stable. And so we're going to see more of the socialist impulse. We're gradually going to see less of the tribal and traditional impulse, but they're both there, and the liberal order kind of has to police them. What do you think of that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got a lot of friends who would disagree with the first thing, who think that we're going to get more tribalistic or we're going to get more tribal. I also happen to think that there are, I mean, this was a very interesting part of the Epstein file. There's an exchange between Peter Thiel and Jeffrey Epstein saying that we're going to push tribalism, right? We're going to push tribalism, which was like, hold on a second, why are Jeffrey Epstein and Peter Thiel doing this? You know, that's kind of interesting. I actually think there's a bit of a, you know, yes, this impulse is there. I think there may also be a bit of an operation to try to foster this in Europe and to foster it to you know, for some end or other. But let's go back a second. There's a couple of things I have to mention. On the John Birchers, I've mentioned this before. I've got this book by James Burnham. Okay, everybody knows him from Managerial Revolution, and they know him from the Machiavellians. Great books. But we also know from Who Paid the Piper that James Burnham was CIA. That James Burnham actually was central to creating the center-left and the center-right, even though he knew that both of them were fictions, okay? Right. But in 1956, he wrote a book called The Web of Subversion, okay, where he basically supplied all of the Reds Under the Bed materials for the John Birchers. So you could actually say that the deep state, Burnham, was supplying the ammo for the Birchers, okay? That's one thing. The other thing is that there's this guy called Revelo P. Oliver. I don't know if you've ever come across him.
I have.
Who was a Bircher. Now, I will say that Revelo P. Oliver is possibly the most anti-Semitic man ever to have lived, right? Even more than Hitler, something like that. He was pretty anti-Semitic, okay? But he was kicked out. He was kicked out of the Birchers around that time that you're talking about. So one section of them went off, and I think they would call like Liberty Bell Productions or like the Liberty Bell Press or something. And he was involved in that, this Revelo P. Oliver.
Right.
But it's obvious that something happened there. And if you want to, he's still like, you can still find lectures of his and writings of Oliver's where he may tell the story of what happened with the Birchers, the capture of them. Okay. With the caveat that he is extremely anti-Semitic. Okay. I'll just give you a trigger warning. Right.
Continue the Boston narrative? Because there's an event that happened 2 years later, right?
Yeah, let's do this.
So this Revolutionary Union, the Revolutionary Communist Party, they were pariahs on the left, right? They were just hated. You know, no leftist would associate with them. They had pandered to racism or whatever. So 1976, right, is the bicentennial of America, the 200-year anniversary. And that's where the Declaration of Independence was signed in Philadelphia. So the U.S. government has a big patriotic rally on July 4th, 1976. And the communists understand that they're going to have to oppose it. So the bulk of the communists in America, they have a gathering in January called the National Hard Times Conference. That's every communist group you ever heard of. They announce that they're going to protest the bicentennial celebrations. And their theme is going to be bicentennial without colonies, right? And they're going to oppose it. It's like America is a colonial, imperialist country, whatever. Well, the RCP is banned from that because of their busing position, right? You know, they're not allowed. So they announced that they're going to have their own rally. And on July 4th, 1976 in Philadelphia, you had the main patriotic rally put on by President Gerald Ford. And then you had two communist rallies that opposed it. One was the mainstream leftist one. It was about 40,000 people, bicentennial without colonies. They bussed in Native Americans from reservations. The gay groups were there. All the Trotskyite, all those groups were there. It was about 40,000 people. The Revolutionary Communist Party had their own rally. It was only about 5,000 people. And their rally was not called bicentennial without colonies. It was called, we've carried the rich for 200 years. Now let's dump them off our backs. Right. That's what they call it. Now, if you go and look at, you know, archival material, according to all the reports, this bicentennial without colonies rallies was way bigger, 40,000 people. I can't find a single picture of it. I can't find a single photo of it, right? It almost didn't matter. But the RCP's rally, that rally, there's loads of photos of it. In fact, there's one photo that has become iconic, and that's of the veterans contingent. They had a veterans contingent at that march, black and white veterans marching behind a banner that said, "We won't fight another rich man's war." And that image of these veterans in their uniforms on the streets of Philadelphia in what looks like a pretty poor neighborhood in Philadelphia, hundreds of veterans marching behind this sign, "We won't fight another rich man's war." That is an iconic image that if you do any anti-war activism in America, you will see that image. That has like gone down in history. And that even though the RCP's rally, when they were like castigated by the left, was much smaller, it had such an impact. It captured the imagination. People saw it. It was speaking to the majority of the American people. Whereas this rally, this other rally, Bicentennial Without Colonies, it was just a collection of identity politics groups, Native Americans, Puerto Rican, Socialist Party, the LGBT, and it's just like, okay, yeah, all right, yeah, okay, America is 200 years old, you think it sucks, whatever. Like, people, it just didn't speak to people. But this RCP rally that they had, "We've carried the rich for 200 years, now let's dump them off our backs. We won't fight another rich man's war." That packed a way bigger punch because it was populism. And that is what the ruling class is really afraid of, populism, right? That's what they're really scared of. They're not scared of just kind of different identity groups having their grievances. They're scared of the masses of the American people and their millions coming together to reject imperialism and globalism, the rule of the world by big bankers. And I look at that and I see that about, you know, about that's the kind of rallies we need. And even if they're smaller, they pack a bigger punch. And that's what the ruling elite is really afraid of. And if that's, I look back on that incident and it's very, very telling. And, you know, anti-populism on the left and the right is how these movements are controlled. On the right, it's Ayn Rand, right? The worship of the individual above all else, like the great man, motor of the world, neoliberal economics, all of that, right? You know, and on the left, it's social liberalism, postmodernism, any collectivist movement is fascist. That is, you know, that's really an expression of philosophical irrationalism. Lukács wrote about philosophical irrationalism, right? The Übermensch who defines his own reality and doesn't conform to this world, right? And there is no real truth. The Übermensch makes his own truth and all that. That's kind of what the elite of the West really believe, right? You can call it Satanism because it's a lot like what Anton LaVey preached. But I mean, you know, if you want to talk about it in a spiritual sense, sure. But it is worship of the individual above all else, rejection of collectivism, and kind of just viewing compassion and any collective sentiment as weakness. That's what the elite really believe. And that's why they're terrified of populism.
Well, one of the things that I've always thought, and this is certainly true in this country, I'm not sure in America, but it's probably true there as well. In this country, a party that was socially conservative while also being socialist, it might, if it had proper money behind it or if it had a proper campaign, would sweep.
Yeah.
Okay. That is the natural mode of the British population. Okay. Fairly big state, socialist economics, wedded to non-woke social conservatism. It's never given. That they always split. It's always, okay, you can have your social conservatism, but it has to come with Thatcher economics. Or you can have your socialism, but it has to come with the rainbow dildo and all the rest of it, right?
Right.
They always do this. You're never given. And you see, the great tragedy is that Trump could have been this, right? Or in this country, there's Reform UK now. Nigel Farage, right? In theory, could have been this. But instead, we're just getting the Tories again. And in America, instead, because of the entrenched interests, you end up with just the Republicans again. It's very frustrating.
You have to now start to talk about the JQ a little bit. Because, you know, there's really no way to avoid it, right? I don't hate anyone on the basis of their ethnicity. And I don't think that, you know, I'm not promoting any form of racism here. But, you know, if you read Marx's writings, right? Marx wrote this very inflammatory essay when he was a young man on the Jewish question, right? And you read it, he's using very heated, offensive words to basically say there is a culture that has developed, right? You have a group of people that have been separated from the rest of society. and they've developed a culture, and he's saying, I want nothing to do with it. Later, you know, Lenin, you know, comes along, and you read Lenin's writings. In Russia, there was something called the Jewish Bund, right? The idea was that, you know, there was a group of Jewish communists in Russia. They said, Jews are so different, so special. We have to have our own separate communist party. Lenin, himself of Jewish descent, says, you know, I'm Jewish or whatever, but I want nothing to do with this. And he calls it, he says, it's the spirit of the ghetto. That's the language he uses. He says that the ultimate expression of the spirit of the ghetto is Zionism, the idea that Jews have to have their own state. They can never fit in Europe. But he says that the spirit of the ghetto expresses itself in the Jewish bond. And if you go further with it, Rosa Luxemburg also, she writes, she says, I don't feel at home in the ghetto. And that all the like Jewish Marxist leaders, like when there were serious big Marxist movements, they say, yeah, I'm Jewish. Yeah, we oppose anti-Semitism. But there is this Jewish culture. We don't want to be a part of it because it hates non-Jews. It sees the bulk of the population as the enemy. And it maintains we are so special and different, and it opposes populism. And I think that's very, very interesting because the left and the right are dominated by that spirit of the ghetto, that anti-populism. And it tends to come from people who for whom that is to some degree or other their cultural heritage. Right. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have people like Max Blumenthal, for example, who, you know, I mean, he's of Jewish descent, but he's spoken out against Zionism and he certainly doesn't buy into this way of being. But they're not simply critique. It's not simply support for Israel. It is this kind of like we are the other and we live in fear of the population. And if they get together, they are very, very dangerous. Theodore Adorno and his writing on the authoritarian personality. Right. Or there's Hannah Arendt and her book. You know, she wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem. I read that book when I was in college. And I thought it was great because I was angry at conformity. And it's like she's writing that, you know, Eichmann, this Nazi guy, he's a conformist. And that's what all the conformists are like. But I look at it now and I realize it's really vile Zionist propaganda, even though Hannah Arendt was quite critical of Israel. You look at it, she's saying that there's nothing special about Eichmann. Deep down, ordinary people are Nazis. That's what she's saying, right? That Eichmann is the personality of evil. Deep down, ordinary people are Nazis, and that fascism isn't capitalism in decay. It's just an expression of the evil of ordinary people. And if you read what Leo Strauss, the father of neoconservatism, wrote, and his teaching with when he wrote about persecution and the art of writing, this notion that all the philosophers of history have had to write in code because if people knew what they really believed, they would persecute them and all of that. This elitism and this idea that ordinary people themselves are the problem, right? Mm. And that what makes the West so great is we control those ordinary people and we don't let them form mass movements, that fascism and communism are the same thing. It's just the vulgar, inferior mobs coming together to persecute the great ones. Like that belief system, which, I mean, really, it's comes from Nietzsche, who was not Jewish at all, right? He was, is accused of being anti-Semitic. But this belief, some people are just superior. And the danger is when the non-superior ones get together and start asserting themselves. That belief, that's what the West is really based on at this point, I would argue. And the left and the right have both been captured by that belief system. And there's a fear of losing control of either of them.
I think we can have this conversation on YouTube, but I'm always kind of, you know, jumpy around this topic, as you can imagine. But we have seen some very visible examples of it in the discourse recently. Do you remember when Mark Levin was feuding with Tucker Carlson, how quickly he went to the notion that all of the people replying to him were just latent Nazis waiting to come out? How quickly he went to that. And he I'm sure he even had a tweet somewhere suggesting that it's in your blood. It's actually just in your blood to hate us. And this seemed to be like a deep belief of Mark Levin. Okay. Yeah. And it's like, well, hold on a second. This guy's a psycho. And the other, speaking of psychos, the other place where it was extremely noticeable, and I think this is one of the big stories, is in the Jeffrey Epstein files. The supremacism of Jeffrey Epstein, the fact that he clearly saw his victims, he clearly saw the people, you know, the people he was bringing to these parties and so on as inferior and therefore fair game. Right now, obviously, this guy was twisted and so on, but it's just how noticeable it is in the emails back and forth with all these different people who use this kind of derogatory language to talk about people in the out group. This I would suggest is an enduring issue that I mean, my understanding of it is that within that group there is a split between people who want to kind of join modernity, people who want to actually like just become part of the modern world, and those people who somehow want to, in a way, live today almost like an ancient, almost like an kind of ancient pre-modern tribe that maintains this almost siege mentality against the rest of the world. And in fact, I've got a very interesting book which delves into this by a Jewish writer. And I see this as an issue that at some point we're going to have to address. Like, well, hold on, you're going to have to deal with this problem because it's causing a lot of problems right now.
Yeah, there's just no way to escape it. Like, I was, for 8 years, I was a member of the Workers' World Party, which is a very pro-Palestine, very anti-Israel organization. And I dealt with, you know, this issue. And I've talked about crypto-Zionism or the spirit of the ghetto. I went to Iran, I came back, I gave a speech, and I remember just being criticized and being told things that were, like, absurd. Like, for example, I was told that the Israelis were victims, right? Well, they didn't know where they were going. They were just taken there, right? And that almost like Israel is a victim of U.S. imperialism. Oh, the Israelis are being used by America. It's like, that's, you look at things like, no, it's not that simple, right? And that's the common leftist narrative. Oh, Israel's just part of American imperialism. American imperialism is the real enemy. Israel is just a puppet, just a tool. No, that's not the case. Israel has its own apparatus and its own strength. And like, for example, one thing that I remember is that, you know, if you would see Zionists, right, saying things like kill all the Arabs, all Arabs are terrorists, right? The response among these very anti-Israel Jewish communists was, that's so sad. That's so sad. However, if they saw white Americans saying, we hate immigrants or whatever, fascist, kill them, evil. And I was just like, well, how come when your people are hateful and bigoted, it's just very sad. But when my people are hateful and bigoted, they're evil and they need to be killed. And the other thing was this white savior complex. That was another thing that I noticed also that drove me crazy. If a white person tried to join the Workers' World Party, and they said, well, I'm against gay marriage, they'd say, be gone. We don't want a homophobe in our group. If a black person tried to join the Workers' World Party and said they were against gay marriage, it was like, oh, of course you are. Of course you are. Yeah, you know, and it was like they kind of viewed black people as like these innocent victims that the state, you know, that are being repressed. And they are the heroic white saviors to protect them. But white workers are the Klan. White workers are the enemy. If they don't immediately check off all the boxes and agree with us, they're the enemy. And there was a lot of that I noticed. And I will never forget. So I went years ago. So the LGBT Center in New York City, which is like a building, right? It's hilarious. But apparently one of their major donors is an Israeli porn star, right? And so because of that, they're not allowed to have any pro-Palestine events at the space. And so to make an act of protest, an Arab LGBT group kind of occupied, they had an event anyway. They went into the space without permission and they had an event and they had a speaker at the event. Her name was Sarah Shulman. And Sarah Shulman is a well-known kind of leftist lesbian memoirist in New York City. And I sat in the audience. I had been in New York City for 4 or 5 years. And it was like a huge wake up for me because I was sitting in the audience and she was telling her life story. And it was about how she, as a Jewish lesbian, came to support the Palestinians. And she started telling her life story. And she said that when she came to America when her family had come to America and when she was growing up in New York City in the 1950s, they didn't hate Arabs. She said they did not hate Arabs. She said that we didn't think about Arabs or whatever. We didn't think about it. She said we hated white European Christians. And we hated white European Christians because they had done the Holocaust, they had done the pogroms, and we sympathized with the black freedom struggle because we saw them as allies against the white European Christians. And it was like, I remember sitting there and like a light bulb went off in my head and I'm like, I get it now, right? And then her speech was largely about how those sentiments in the Jewish community have been kind of eroded because now you know, the sentiment among Jews is kind of hatred for Arabs, you know, and the, especially right-wing Zionism is very tied in with the religious right and all of that. But as Trump was rising, I understood why, you know, there was this refusal to ever understand that people might vote for Trump for a good reason, because they actually wanted to end the wars. They actually wanted him to bring the jobs back. And there was this kind of phobia of the bulk of the population. And I remember I was told by one of the leaders of the Workers' World Party, I'm from Ohio. She told me that, quote, everyone in Ohio believes that Jews have horns and tails. And I said to her, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I've never met anyone in my life who believes that Jews have horns and tails. And she says, no, that's what everyone in Ohio believes. I know this for a fact. Like, that spirit of the ghetto, even among very anti-Israel, they understand that Israel's bad, but it's like they oppose Israel, but it's like even in their narrative, Israel is an example of what would happen if all the people in Ohio came together and set up a country. Like, it's anti-populism, right? That their whole narrative is we are persecuted, we are the others, and that leftism is ultimately a populist movement, right? The Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx writes, he says, all previous movements in history have been movements of minorities, but we are building a movement for the immense majority, on behalf of the immense majority. But you can't really maintain the spirit of the ghetto and believe that, right? You know, you believe the immense majority is the enemy. And that's why if you look throughout, like, again, you look at the statements of Lenin, you look at the statements of Rosa Luxemburg, you look at even Marx himself, in order to really be mass organizers and build a working class movement, they have to do this, we don't identify with Jewishness. You know, it's fascinating to me. And it's strange. And again, like you said, we're going to have to address this, right? The reason that the Palestine movement in America couldn't be the obvious winning message of American flags, not Palestinian flags, money for this country, not some country in the Middle East. Why don't we build schools and hospitals in America instead of bombing people on the other side of the world? That would have been the winning message. But instead, the message was, fuck you, burn it down, racist, sexist America. There's a reason for that. And that's because the left is dominated by the spirit of the ghetto, as is the right. And that is something I've come to understand in my development. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've told this story countless times. My kind of same moment, the light bulb moment, was when I was watching a video from The Atlantic magazine from 2015. Okay. The speaker was this guy, you may have seen him before. I think he's like a liberal guy. He's got big white hair. His name's Leon Weisleiter, right? Big white hair, bald. I think he had a bit of trouble with he was caught up in Me Too or something, right? Yeah. But anyway, the discussion was, should the Jews leave Europe? Okay. And one of the things that I found stunning about this conversation, there were three guys from The Atlantic magazine. This guy was one of them, all three of them were, Jewish Americans. They were having this whole conversation, and he was like, "Look, the liberal experiment has failed. We tried to do this, blah blah blah." But the candidness, the ethnocentrism, the almost open racism, right, of the whole conversation, and then the denouement was at the end of the video. He's asked, what should the last Jewish person leaving Europe do? And his answer is spit. Okay. Now, this same guy, the same Leon Weisleiter, I then saw in another context where he was having a debate with a French Christian nationalist. Okay. This was during the rise of Le Pen in that era. And he was absolutely berating her for being a French nationalist, for, not being liberal, for, some of the illiberal stuff she was saying. And I was like, is this the same man? Is he aware that he's doing it? And one of the things that I've concluded, Caleb, and this is a difficult thing to articulate, is that I am not convinced that some of these people are aware. I honestly think that they're just not aware that they're doing it. This is how, you get Ben Shapiro talking endlessly about identity politics when his whole thing is identity politics.
Right.
When it's like, he's against identity politics, but also his whole gimmick is identity politics. And he just doesn't see it. I think he's incapable of recognizing the double standard or recognizing the hypocrisy which is obvious to everybody else, but it's like, I mean, it's like being caught in a, I honestly think they cannot see it.
Yeah, and that, you know, it's centuries of trauma, of pogroms, of the Holocaust, of all of that. But it's also, you know, like, I remember when I first moved to New York, I worked at an insurance company. And it's like, it's not just the trauma, it's they're like re-traumatizing their own children in a way. Like, that's what Zionism is about. One of my coworkers, I remember, like, I first started working at this insurance company. One of my coworkers was talking about how her son wouldn't go to a movie theater in Brooklyn because it was near a mosque, because he went to a Jewish school, and they showed him lots of movies about bombings and stuff. And her son was literally terrified to go to this movie theater because it was near a mosque, because he thought it would get blown up. You know, like if you're traumatizing your children from that young of an age. And I've talked to Jewish people who've talked about how, like, when they were children, they were afraid to take a shower. They were afraid to go into the shower because they'd seen so much, you know, horrifying material about the Holocaust. They were like afraid the shower might gas them to death or something. Like, if you're traumatizing children from that young age and telling them everyone's out to get you, everyone wants to kill you, you know, I mean, is it a shock that they, I mean, they, like you said, it's internal. They're not even consciously thinking about it, right? It's just something they've come to believe. You know, I remember at my college that I went to, the LGBT organization showed a pro-Palestine film. It was just like a very liberal pro-Palestine film. Like, it had Noam Chomsky and a couple people talking in it. And I remember some of the Jewish students at my college, you know, shouting at one of the people in the LGBT organization, the people who made that film would cut your head off. And I'm thinking, no, they wouldn't. Like, Noam Chomsky is not going to cut your head off for being gay. But in their mind, every person who opposes Israel is part of this vulgar mob of Muslim, you know, head chopping. You know, it's like they're, it's not just the trauma of the past. It's the re-traumatization as a form of mind control, right? If you re-traumatize your children, I mean, it's deeply unhealthy. And that, you know, this Zionism is largely based on these sentiments. It's not simply, you know, that Zionism pushes this. It's a mindset that has developed that is kind of captured control of American politics to some degree or other, and is very, very dangerous. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you have to love people. You really do, right? And you can't be antisocial. You can't be, you know, misanthropic, right? If we're going to have anything good happen in the world, we have to embrace humanity and expect the best from it. And Malthusianism, the ideology of globalism, imperialism, of the British Empire, was the belief that humans are a cancer on the planet. Humans are the problem, right? And that you know, and that's very much the ideology of you know, of the ultra rich going back generations. The idea, well, there's too many people there. You know, Winston Churchill, I think in India, he blamed a famine on the people of India. They breed like rabbits or something like that, right? That anti-humanism, right, is so much a part of what this system needs because of overproduction and because of the built-in problems of capitalism. The only way they can restart the system is with mass destruction and depopulation, where ultimately, if we had a rationally organized economy, the sky's the limit. We could create a world of vast abundance. But this irrational economic system needs to drive down the population, drive down living standards. And so it has attached itself to anti-populist and anti-human sentiments, which dominate both the left and the right, and that ultimately we need a movement that embraces and loves humanity, which is just going against all the pessimism that is spewed at us through our phones every day, through TV, through mainstream media, through academia, whether it's global warming, whether it's, I mean, you name it, we're constantly just being spoon-fed this anti-human pessimism. That's my take.
Well, one of the things that concerns me, Caleb, is that I believe it's been an active strategy on the part of the Zionists to you know, enlist or to co-opt European and American populism, almost to try to inculcate in some of the people who were part of these movements, right wingers in particular, this siege mentality that we've been talking about, almost seeing Israel as something to emulate, right? This is a talking point I've seen in British politics, right?
Yes.
Where they want almost for Brit, like young British guys to say, like, to look at Israel and say, we want that here. The trouble is, Caleb, right, as somebody who, okay, I'm known for being grumpy and a bit misanthropic, but I don't hate humanity. And I genuinely don't think it's a healthy thing to want to be. I don't want to be, I look at Israel and be like, that's the last country on earth I want to be like, right? I don't want to be, you know, surrounded by enemies on all sides, you know, distrustful and having to look over your shoulder. This is like not healthy,
right?
Not a healthy mindset. And yet this is, it seems to me, there's been a real attempt and, you know, for better or for worse, Elon Musk has been part of this to try to get, you know, Europeans and Americans to think like this.
Yeah. That, well, why do you think
anywhere good? Yeah. Go
why
on,
do you think after the death of Charlie Kirk, it was all over the media that leftists are cheering for the murder of this man, right? Charlie Kirk, you know, I don't agree with a lot of what he said, but I wasn't going, woohoo, they got him. I was horrified by the way he was killed, but it was amplified all over social media. If you're a leftist, you must celebrate the killing. And it was blasted at right-wingers. Anyone who's left-wing wants to kill you. Look at the awful way this person you admire was killed. That's what the leftists want to do to you. It's that exact same thing you're talking about. Trauma. That's how they're going to prevent a populist movement. The years of lead. This is my book, The Danger of an American Years of Lead. They did this in Italy. In Italy in the 1970s, you had a mass movement that was emerging that wanted Italy to leave NATO. It included the Communist Party, included the Christian Democratic Party. They were even talking about forming a coalition government. That they're saying Italy for Italians, not for NATO, not for the British Empire, not for globalism. And the way the CIA divided it was with Operation Gladio, where they were funneling money and weapons to far left, red brigades, far right, fascist groups. And there was a mass killing and mass shooting and all of this. And the Italian public became weary of all the violence. And still to this day, Italy is in NATO. And that's what they're trying to do right now. They're using that same trauma mindset. If you get people to think other people want to kill them, if you get people to know people who've been killed, or if you get people injured, they can't work together, right? You draw a river of blood between people and you traumatize a population. People eventually just get tired of it and want the killing to stop. This is how the counterinsurgency is being waged. It is weaponizing the same kind of trauma that we described of, you know, the reason these Zionists think everyone's out to kill them is because they're traumatized by horrendous events and they re-traumatize their children. That's what they're doing here. Right. And I think you're absolutely right in creating that siege mentality on the right. If you convince everyone on the right that anyone who wears a Bernie Sanders button wants them gunned down the way Charlie Kirk is gunned down, they're never going to work together. If you convince everyone on the left that that, you know, everyone on the right is in the Ku Klux Klan or is in ICE and wants to, you know, shoot them on the streets of Minneapolis, they're never going to work together. And if you create like this fear and traumatized mindset, eventually people just get into this kind of weary state of lassitude where they don't resist, they don't get involved in politics, and the status quo wins by default. And, you know, that's what I've talked about. You know, the counterinsurgency writer, William S. Lind, he talks about how when insurgencies are successful, they create the David versus Goliath setup, right? Where, you know, everyone for the last 4,000 years, they've told the story of David and Goliath. Everyone always supports David because he's up against Goliath. So if you have a David versus Goliath fight, even if Goliath might win the first 10 rounds, everyone's still going to be cheering for David. So what you do is you have David step back and you create seven different Davids who are always fighting with each other. No one knows who the real David is. Sometimes one David gets support, sometimes another one gets support. And Goliath just stands back and says, I don't want to fight anybody. Why can't we all just get along? Goliath wins by default. That's the game of counterinsurgency. And that's how they're doing it. You hit the nail on the head. Brilliant. Exactly right. This kind of traumatization, creating a siege mentality among people, creating fear. That's how they're preventing the rise of the real mass movement against globalism and imperialism that needs to happen, is long overdue in the West.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of civil war talk that goes on, especially on the right. Right? Do you think that there's any danger that they? Because I mean, one of the reasons that I've been so disgusted at the American right recently was because after Charlie Kirk, right, I can understand how they've got into this mindset, but you know, to me, it was obvious that when the things happened with the ICE officer, right, they put 10 rounds into that guy. I mean, this is obviously just way over the top. And okay, even if you support ICE, okay, there's a way of saying, like, well, it's a shame that this happened. They could have been more professional, but ultimately I still support, you know, immigration's a problem, it has to be, but You don't have to, but that's not what happened. What happened is that, driven by bloodlust and revenge for Charlie Kirk, they memed Rene Good and the other guy, Petit. They memed them with nooses. And, you know, I was like, come on, guys. This is like, you've lost the moral high ground now that you've built up over a decade. This is going to be used again. It's already in our press, being anybody who talks about immigration now in our press, immediately it's like, what, you want a British ICE now? Right? So it's already being used as a cudgel against the right, this sort of behavior. But you can see how it was seeded. You can see how they've got into this mindset. And it's obviously non-productive. It's obviously a backward step for me. So
yeah, we're supposed to cheer on government repression and death as long as it happens to the other team. Right. And that's the false polarization. Woke versus MAGA if the government comes for one of us, oh, that's awful. It's repression. If the government comes for one of them, well, they're bad. They have it coming. That's the game that they're playing. But Marjorie Taylor Greene broke with that. And she compared Alex Preddy's death to the death of Ashley Babbitt, who was gunned down inside the U.S. Capitol. And again, I keep coming back to the dissident MAGA right now. This could change. But right now, the dissident MAGA is where the energy is. That's where we need. That's where the hope for an anti-imperialist movement is right now. At the end of the day, that's what I'm looking at. But yeah, no, you're right. It is. If you get into this red team versus blue team mentality, you know, the other thing that infuriated me was the Uhuru movement. Right. This is an example of how completely hypocritical the woke crowd is. Right. So there's a group of black socialists. They're called the African People's Socialist Party, the Uhuru movement. In 2022. Their homes were all raided by the FBI, and they were charged not with any crime, but just with, you know, advocating on behalf of the Russian government. That was the charge against them. They didn't accuse them of murdering anybody or drugs or anything like that. They just said they are acting as foreign agents of Russia because they've had some Zoom calls, because they published some articles, because they went to a conference in Russia a couple of years before that, right? And they were ready to throw them in prison for 15 years. And again, you would think all these woke people, a group of black socialists, the FBI is coming after them just for their speech, you would support them, right? Nope. Nope. Immediately the memos went out all over social media. Uhuru is a cult. Well, who cares? Well, first of all, if they were, so what? And I mean, they're not. They're actually a group that does a lot of very good work in the black community. But none of these leftists would support them. And Vosh on his channel, oh, well, they're a cult, and they're connected to this other group that had some sex scandal or something, so whatever. And all these people that are like, all they talk about is racism, and they've got pictures of Fred Hampton, and they're reading books about the FBI going after the Black Panthers. Here we have, in 2022, the federal government going after a black socialist group for their speech, and these people couldn't do anything about it because the internet said so. If that doesn't tell you how controlled the woke people are, I mean, and you know who did support them? Tucker Carlson. And you know why Tucker Carlson supported them? Because of my organization. Tara Reid, who was sexually assaulted by Joe Biden, we gave her an award at our conference in Chicago a week after the FBI raided the Uhuru House. And we invited the Uhuru House, you know, the Uhuru movement, to make a statement. Tara Reid heard about the Uhuru movement at our conference, and she forwarded their information to Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson, the week before they took him off Fox News, did stories defending them. He ended up, and he supported them, right? And that was because of our intervention, right? Because we knew somebody, Tara Reid, and we connected her with the Uhuru movement. She knew Tucker Carlson and we were able to highlight their case, and they were acquitted on the main charge of being Russian agents. They convicted them of conspiracy. They expect that to be overturned in appeal. But I was out in front of the federal courthouse in Tampa on the day their trial started. I was out in front of their court of the courthouse on the day they were sentenced. And my organization, we raised their case. We brought their case up in Russia. We arranged a UN press conference about their case. But all these woke people did absolutely nothing to support them because the internet says they're bad. The internet says they're a cult. This is the game that's being played, right? This is how they control people. People have got to stop listening to the internet. The internet is rigged, right? I am an adherent of the dead internet theory. The overwhelming majority of stuff on the internet is not real. Stuff is amplified. It's fake. And you know, like, if they can come for them for their speech related to Russia, they can come for anybody. And in the lead up to the 2024 elections, they raided Scott Ritter's home. He was next in line. If Kamala Harris had been elected president, they were going to charge Scott Ritter with being a foreign agent of Russia. And, you know, I'm sure there were a number of other names on that list that you and I are very familiar with, right? They were going to start going down the line. And the fact that the left couldn't defend one of their own because Russia bad, because the internet says they're bad, that right there tells me how controlled the left is, right? And seeing, though, people like Tucker Carlson speak up on their behalf, that was really inspiring. So, you know, we need to get past the red team versus blue team, you know, mindset. I'm not against conservatives. I am against globalism, imperialism. I am against the rule of the world by big banks and big corporations that are making the world poorer and grinding nations into poverty in order to enrich themselves. And I think the only future that America can have is joining with the new economy rising around the world and breaking out of the rule of the international bankers. We need a government of action that fights for working families. That's what we need. And I know conservatives want that. Maybe they don't know it yet, but they want it. I know leftists, if they're really sincere in socialistic and anti-imperialist sentiments, that's what they want. And that's the kind of movement we need. And that's the kind of movement I want to build.
Fantastic, Caleb. I mean, I wrote an article a couple of weeks back called Escaping the Slop Right Matrix. And I've been, I got pushback. I was called all sorts of names, but I'm cautiously optimistic that this message is getting through, and especially since Epstein files, more and more people, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Tucker Carlson, et cetera, are in some ways leaving the slop right matrix. My question to you is, how optimistic would you be of leftists leaving what you might call the slop left matrix?
I think it comes with experience. I think that you have to get out there and do it. You know, I've noticed that it used to be when I was just kind of a regular leftist or communist, I would get a lot of 19 and 20 year olds who'd want to get involved. But I've noticed now the kind of people that come around my organization tend to be in their, you know, late 20s or early 30s. And that's because I think you really have to just live it and experience it, in order to understand where we're coming from and trying to break out of the left-right dichotomy and build a real anti-imperialist organization. Look, for the longest time in America, really since the 60s, since the 70s, communism in America has been a college phase that you're supposed to go through, right? You're in college, you're hearing these new ideas for the first time, you have a Marxist professor, and so you join one of these communist groups for a year or two. And it's exciting. But then after a year or two, you realize the group is never really going to grow. It has no vision to actually grow and expand. And you kind of move on with your life. And then you just kind of hate communism for the rest of your life. Or you just look back on that as kind of like, that was something silly I did in my 20s. That's what most of the communist groups in America are. They are designed to be a college phase that you grow out of, right? If you go to countries in the world that have real anti-imperialist movements, that's not what they are. They're in communities. They're in neighborhoods. They're providing services to people. They run food banks. They are almost like playing the role that the church might have played in a different time as a community of people in the neighborhood asserting their own economic interest. That's the kind of organization that we need. And that's what, you know, to some degree or other, the new communist movement of the 70s was trying to build. They were not very successful, but they were aspiring to build that. The slogan that I have used is out of the movement to the masses. I want nothing to do with the left movement. I want to organize among the masses. And, you know, I have a different view than the Uhuru movement, this group that was prosecuted in the United States. I'm not, you know, I don't view race in the same way that they do. But that's what they've done. They're not interested in recruiting activists. They want to recruit in the neighborhood, and they run community programs, and they teach an anti-colonial, anti-imperialist ideology. We need to build an anti-colonial, anti-globalist, anti-imperialist mass movement that champions the rights of working families in America. That's what I'm striving to build. I would like to see community centers all across this country where people are getting services and people are getting involved in community work and also being taught an anti-imperialist ideology. That's what I would like to see built. And that's what urgently needs to happen. The left movement is a dead end. The right movement is a dead end. We need to get to the masses of people and build a real movement among the population.
If people want to find out more, Caleb, where can they go?
Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org.
Fantastic. I'll just remind people, pick up a course at the academic agency. Been absolutely fascinating as ever, Caleb. I always learn something when we talk. Hopefully this one will stay up, fingers crossed, but we'll see. I'd love to talk to you again sometime.
All right. Thanks.
Just to let you know, it's going to kick us out here. So when this is a goodbye properly as well. All right.
Thanks.
Cheers, Caleb.
Yep.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.